Now we're joined by the experts at Vettafi, a new data analytics and thought leadership company that is transforming financial services from an industry to a community, one relationship at a time.
$800 billion, I think we have to say that again, $800 billion and counting for an industry that is still growing in size is impressive.
Todd, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Great to be with you again.
All right. So, look, real quick, before we get into the survey data I mentioned, there was some interesting news related to ETFs last week where I'm sure you saw this. Bloomberg reported that Fidelity is going to charge a $100 fee, $100 fee to their clients who wish to buy ETFs from nine issuers. That includes Simplify ETFs and Axis Investments. And I just thought this was a noteworthy story to cover on the podcast. This caught me a little by surprise, I would say. I'm just curious, did you have any reaction to that?
Well, I remember back in the day, and maybe you and the listeners would, that, 2017, 2018, 2019, give or take, when we didn't have commission-free trading on for ETFs on Schwab and Fidelity and the various platforms. That's actually only been around for 5 or 6 years. It used to be only selected ETFs. So on Fidelity's platform, you could trade Fidelity ETFs, and iShares was their preferred partner. Schwab had a select list of products, not from any asset manager beyond their own, but some from WisdomTree and from Xtrackers and JP Morgan. And essentially, asset managers would pay to be on that commission-free platform. Where it sounds like we're headed back to that, where Fidelity is going to fund its commission-free trading of ETFs from the asset managers if they're willing to pay it. And if not, then the end investor is going to have to pay in order to trade on Fidelity's platform. I wish this was not the case, but distribution success is not for free. This is a for-profit business within the ETF industry, and this is how the world works. So I'm not that surprised by it, but I certainly wish that ETFs were available for everybody on a level playing field.
Yeah, I think my disappointment here is you and I always talk about how ETFs have democratized investing and brought all of these innovative strategies and access to asset classes to everyday investor. A lot of strategies and asset classes that were previously only available to institutional investors. And I 100% agree with what you're saying in terms of, look, these are a platform like Fidelity. This is a for-profit business. They have to make money. I get all that. I just worry that actions such as this disproportionately impact smaller ETF issuers. And you may disagree with this. I would mount the argument, and maybe we should do this on a future podcast, that the smaller ETF issuers are really the incubators of innovation and asset management. And so if you kind of connect the dots here, which I don't think is hard to do, I think when you start putting up gates like this, it really impacts smaller issuers. And so some of the innovation doesn't make its way into the hands of investors, because obviously smaller ETF issuers don't have the same type of financial wherewithal as your largest issuers, who this is a drop in the bucket. If they have to pay Fidelity for whatever they're calling it, a maintenance arrangement or operations or however they're positioning it, that's no big deal for somebody like BlackRock or Vanguard. But for somebody, say, like Simplify ETFs, that's a meaningful expense on their financials. And so maybe they can't do it. And I guess the other thing I would say here, too, if you're going to do something like this, I hear what you're saying, how all these platforms went to commission-free trading. But even back when they were charging commissions in that 2017 timeframe, we were talking about what, a $9.95, $9.99 ticket charge? This is a $100 fee. I mean, I could see you have somebody go in and try to buy one of these ETFs, not realizing that they're getting dinged for $100. I guess that part maybe stuck out to me more than anything. But I just worry. I don't like seeing we've always known that there's gatekeeping in the ETF industry. That's nothing new, especially when you start talking about the wirehouse world and the process that you have to go through if you're an ETF issuer to have your products on those platforms and then be accessible by the advisors there. I just somebody like Fidelity, like, does this really matter at the end of the day to them? This I talked about for the larger issuers, this not being a big expense. What about for somebody like Fidelity? Are they really making that much revenue off something like this that it's worth the negative PR?
I hear you, and this will certainly, you know, for someone who's coming to market and expecting that if they start with an asset base of, you know, seed capital of $1 million, they have to build in now that there's a cost to being available, having their ETFs available on a platform. And maybe that holds them back from launching the ETF. I hope that isn't the case, but yeah, I can certainly see I see why this caught your eye. I see why this is not ideal.
Yeah, and on the other hand, I think longtime listeners know at the end of the day, look, I'm a free market capitalist. So look, you're running a business, you can do whatever you want. I'm also obviously a huge ETF industry advocate. And again, I just feel like the smaller issuers are where a lot of the innovation is happening. And I worry that moving forward, actions such as this, especially if we see more of them, really can hurt that innovation. But in any event, let's move on. So VettaFi hosted this equity symposium for financial advisors a few weeks ago. And as part of that, as you typically do with these events, VettaFi surveyed those advisors on a variety of topics. You have been kind enough to share the results with myself and obviously ETF Prime listeners this week. And I think, you know, Todd, I just love going through this type of data because it provides a real-time window into how advisors are thinking, which obviously that impacts their clients' experience, but it also impacts things like ETF flows, which you and I both like watching. And I would say even how ETF issuers approach new launches and those sorts of things. So let's just dive in here and go through some of the findings. I pulled out a number of the questions that I found particularly interesting. So again, let's just dive in. And first, VettaFi asked the question, which factor looks appealing to you in the current environment? And the top two responses by far were growth with 37% and quality with 26%. So let's start there. What did you make of those results?
Yeah, I'm going to take a slight step back just to set the stage. We did a couple-hour event. There were almost 500 live attendees, primarily financial advisors. So this is a good cross-segment. Again, this is a sample, and this is self-selected advisors that are responding to this. But I'm not surprised that growth was at the top of the list. And some people don't think of growth as a factor the same way they think of quality and value, momentum, low vol, size, but growth is a factor. And we're seeing, obviously, the mega cap growth stocks led the market in 2023 and to start beginning of 2024. So I'm not surprised growth was at the top of the list. Quality is encouraging to me. Quality is one of those, you know it when you see it, you think, but that's companies with strong balance sheets and consistent earnings records and often free cash flow generation. And I love this data too, so much that I end up writing articles on ETFtrends.com about the output of that data and then examples of ETFs. So let me just highlight a couple of ETFs that I recently wrote about. American Century has a U.S. quality growth ETF. The ticker is QGRO, QGRO, that combines that quality and growth metric, so strong balance sheets, consistent earnings records, but also growth traits. And so companies like ServiceNow and TJX and Booking Holdings are some of the examples of what's inside the portfolio. And then I recently wrote yesterday about the Cash Cows ETF. And now the Pacer U.S. Cash Cow ETF, Cows, COWZ, is the most popular of these free cash flow ETFs. But we also touched on the Victory Shares free cash flow ETF because it has a growth tilt. So VFLOW, that's the Victory Shares ETF, takes a more forward-looking approach to cash flow, which has actually helped it to outperform a little bit better in 2024. And just one quick note, I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but iShares announced that it's going to change one of its traditional growth-oriented ETFs into a quality growth at a reasonable price ETF under the ticker GARP, G-A-R-P. in a couple of months. So it's going to be value and quality together. So tilting away from growth and into more value to offer a twist towards the very popular QUAL ETF.
I did not see that. What a great ticker symbol, by the way. I wonder how long they've been sitting on that. I know. that's wild. My quick comment here, I agree with you. The interest around growth is no surprise given the performance we've seen there. With quality, I don't think this is anything enlightening. I do think there is a growing segment of advisors who are looking out on the economic horizon here. And there is some concern that perhaps we get a slowdown or the Fed doesn't quite get this this landing right. And if you believe that's the case, you probably want to be positioned in more of a quality fashion. So that makes sense to me that there's interest there. And as you've highlighted, there's no shortage of ETF products in that space. All right. The next polling question that I found interesting was this one. So how much of your equity exposure in average client portfolios is in actively managed strategies? And the results here were more dispersed than that last question. So about 32% said more than half of their client portfolios were in active strategies. 21% said between 26 and 50% of their client portfolios were in active strategies. 23% said between 11 and 25% of portfolios. And then the rest was less than 10%. Did those results surprise you at all? I guess I would have thought a smaller percentage in active overall, but maybe I'm just biased towards indexing.
So it is, the numbers are different than we would have expected. I would have thought we would have seen a lower percentage in actively managed strategies. Now, I wrote the question intentionally a little vague. So it doesn't say actively managed ETFs. It didn't say actively managed funds. It said actively managed strategies. In part because we had, during this equity symposium, we had some active equity mutual fund participants. So that's certainly probably in the mix. This isn't just all ETFs. And you as an advisor, if you own in a couple of individual stocks, you might consider that to be an actively managed strategy that you are actively managing. But that said, I am excited about what this means for the ETF industry. As you know, active ETFs have been punching above their weight. They did so in 2022. They did so in 2023. To start this year in 2024, they've been popular as well, both active equity and active fixed income. Some of that data is skewed by BlackRock putting active ETFs in their model portfolios away from indexing products. But I do think it's encouraging. There's still a lot of money in actively managed mutual funds. We, as an industry in the ETF space, notice the net outflows, but there's still a lot of money that's there that might move over to the active ETF space as many of these firms come to market with an active equity version of some of their popular strategies. And whether it's Capital Group, that's the success that it's had that we've talked about, you know, Morgan Stanley has recently expanded into the active space, and we've got BlackRock doing so, as I talked about, with some of their model efforts. So this is encouraging to me for active management in the ETF space.
Yeah, 100% agree with your broad takeaway there. That's exactly what I thought. So while the results here surprised me a little bit, it is also reflective of the interest we are seeing around active ETFs. And you just named some of the major players that are either now getting involved or getting much more involved in the active ETF arena. So that momentum is going to continue. On that note, the next question I selected, this was also tied to active strategies, and I really like this one. So the question was, which investment style would you consider investing in actively managed ETFs? And I should note, people could select more than one answer here when you hear these results. But the runaway winner was U.S. small and mid caps. So 76% of respondents said they would consider active ETFs here. The second highest response was international equities with 58%. And then 50% said they would consider active in U.S. large caps and thematic equity strategies. And then finally, 39% said they would consider active in fixed income. What did you think about the small and mid cap standing out like that?
So again, I was encouraged by this, and let me just cite the latest SPIVA scorecard from S&P Dow Jones Indices. It showed that small and mid-cap, those are active mutual funds, but they did better versus their respective S&P benchmarks than the large cap space over the last 3 years. It was, in small caps, it was roughly half of the active small cap mutual funds were performing in line or better than the benchmark. And so I like the fact that I also wrote about this piece, thanks for highlighting content that I have on ETFtrends.com, looking at some of the active small cap funds, small cap equity ETFs that are available. And so I highlighted Dimensional Funds and Avantis that tilt towards quality and value in these broadly diversified ETFs. Their respective small cap ETFs, AVSC is the Avantis one, DFAC is the Dimensional one. Both of those have outperformed in the past year. The iShares S&P 600 small cap index ETF, that's encouraging that they are performing well. And then I also highlighted a few of the more concentrated products. So we've got some of the leaders in this space. Fidelity has a small cap ETF, FFSM. T. Rowe Price has a small mid-cap ETF. The ticker is TMSL. And then Goldman Sachs has one that I highlighted. The ticker is GSC. So apologies for listing a bunch of products that are out there, but those are well-known asset managers that now have a small cap presence. And I'll just state the obvious. These are relatively small ETFs, which to me is a good thing because, as you know, as an advisor, many active small cap mutual funds that perform well close their door to new investors. That is down the road a risk for active small cap ETFs, but right now with $100 million or less, these funds can certainly stay open for the foreseeable future.
My quick color commentary here would just be that I can tell you in conversations I've had with investors and other advisors, small caps definitely seem to have some momentum behind them, with the thought being they've underperformed large cap, you know, fairly substantially over the last several years. And there's this feeling that maybe they could play catch up and show some outperformance here moving forward. The reason why that's important as it pertains specifically to actively managed ETFs, I think a lot of advisors and investors would tell you there's some concern about a lot of landmines in the small cap space. We've talked about zombie companies before, and you know, especially with interest rates where they're at, some of these over-leveraged companies not being able to really service their debt. And so maybe having an active manager at the wheel here can do a better job of sidestepping some of those landmines and then obviously pursuing opportunities. So I did think that was interesting. By the way, were you surprised fixed income was so low? That's actually where I thought we would have seen more advisors say they're interested in active strategies. I think especially given the rate environment and uncertainty around the Fed and inflation, did that surprise you at all?
It did. Now, I guess the caveat that this question was asked during an equity symposium,
fair.
So perhaps
yeah.
The advisors that are interested in active fixed income weren't, you know, this is a subset of the advisor community. And I certainly believe that they're there based on the flows, based on money continuing to go into active, both fixed income mutual funds and ETFs. And as you noted, at the top of the show, we have a fixed income symposium taking place coming up in a couple of weeks on April 18th with many of the active managers like Capital Group and PIMCO. So I know they're out there, advisors, but they just didn't respond as aggressively in this poll question.
Well, you have a good to-do for that fixed income symposium to bless us with some more excellent data like this from advisors. Just a few minutes left here, Todd. I want to touch on a couple more questions. And Vettify did have several polling questions around international stocks. And the one I want to ask you about in particular was, how much exposure do you have in emerging market equities in your average client portfolio? And I'll tell you, the results here didn't surprise me one bit. So 55% said only between 1% and 5% of their portfolio was in emerging market stocks. 28% said emerging market stocks represent between 6 and 10% of their client portfolios. 13% said zero, and then 4% said more than 10%. And again, this didn't surprise me at all, just given the returns we've seen over the past decade or so. I think, you know, I love giving this stat, and this is 100% cherry-picked. But if you look at the iShares Emerging Markets ETF, ticker EEM, that thing has returned exactly 13% since right before the global financial crisis in December 2007. That's total return over that time period. But in any event, any comments on the results of this question?
So again, I'm not surprised at all, although the people who have zero exposure to it, that's a bit surprising to me, in that is at some point emerging markets will do better. That's just, you know, the data will back that up, but also what type of emerging markets ETF. So as you've talked about on the show beforehand, the emerging markets ex-China ETFs have been popular. iShares has the largest of those products, EMXC, that's tied to the MSCI Emerging Markets broader index. It just strips out China from it. Columbia has one of these products also. The ticker is XCEM. That's been very popular as well. And I think we both know Perth Toll relatively well. Perth runs the index behind the Freedom 100 emerging markets ETF. The ticker is FRDM, which is freedom weighted, which means China currently doesn't score very well and probably won't for my lifetime and yours. And that ETF, FRDM, is now $800 million in assets under management. So a sign that you can gather assets and you can actually perform well with certain emerging markets ETFs.
I'm glad you mentioned Perth Toll and the Freedom 100 Emerging Markets ETF, because perfect example of somebody who actually was able to push through the those gatekeepers we were talking about at the top of the show, and with what Fidelity's doing. I love seeing the success of that ETF, as you said, of around $800 million in assets. What an ETF success story. Todd, the last question I'm going to ask you is on thematic ETFs, which I think, you know, is a topic I always like discussing. And so the polling question you had was, how much does your average client portfolio have allocated to thematic ETFs? And just like with emerging market stocks, I would say this one didn't surprise me at all. So 38% said they only had between 1 and 5%. 27% said they had between 6 and 10% of their portfolio in thematic ETFs. 19% said zero. And then 17% said more than 10%, which I would say that seems a little high, but I guess that really depends on the type of strategy someone is running. But here's my question for you. Do you think there's too much focus from ETF issuers on the thematic ETF space? Because I think most people would agree thematic should only represent a smaller satellite position in a portfolio. And the results of your polling data would suggest that advisors agree with that as well, right? But I feel like we continue to see launch after launch after launch in the thematic ETF category. Is there too much product here? Like, shouldn't ETF issuers be paying more attention to data like yours instead of launching, the 12th cannabis ETF or whatever?
Well, so I think there's too many products overall in general, although as the head of research for TMX Vetify, I'm happy to continue to cover them. And I know you're happy to talk about the 3,000-plus ETFs week to week. But yes, there's too many thematic ETFs. There's too many a range of different ETFs. I would argue there's too many Bitcoin ETFs. We now have 11, if I can slip in Bitcoin into the end of this segment. We've got 11 now, and Grayscale is going to offer a 12th one unless somebody beats them to it with their second product. So there's a lot of asset managers going after a small subset of the asset base that's available because they can't compete with the S&P 500 based products that are the core. But I couldn't help myself if we don't talk briefly about, it's important to look inside thematic ETFs. They're not all the same, unlike the Bitcoin ETFs, that the exposure is going to be the same. Let me just pick two products. Amplify has an online retail ETF. iBuy and ProShares has an online retail ETF, ONLN. iBuy has 70 holdings. The largest weighting is roughly 5%. ProShares has 19 holdings, and Amazon's weighting is a quarter of the portfolio. Those are very different ETFs. So if you have something different than what's out there, then it might make sense to appeal to an advisor, an investor base, even for their very small slice of the portfolio.
Yeah, and maybe to counter what I was saying, perhaps that's why we see ETF issuers launching a lot of category in the space, because they feel like they can differentiate, right? They feel like they can take a different tack towards a particular thematic ETF category and differentiate and hopefully be able to attract some investor interest. And I also don't want to contradict what I was saying at the beginning in terms of ETF innovation, because a lot of these smaller ETF issuers, for whatever reason, do seem to focus on the thematic category. And I think that gets back to what you were saying. They don't necessarily have to compete with the BlackRocks and Vanguards of the world in core portfolio exposure. So I like that we see innovation here. I would just suggest that if you're an ETF issuer listening to this podcast, maybe pay some attention to the Vettify advisor polling data. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I certainly would agree with that. And that's part of why we do this, is to hear from advisors, so that asset managers, so that we can do it ourselves, to be able to talk and educate. You want to go where the investor interest is, and you want to use data to help be a true source for you, as opposed to what is your gut and do you think you can compete within that overall space. Data is definitely your friend.
The absolute perfect bookend to our conversation. Todd, great stuff as always. Again, I just love seeing how other advisors are thinking about portfolio construction. Always interesting. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Todd Rosenbluth, head of research at Vettify.